Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford, and I'll be taking your calls and answering your questions for the next hour or so. Lisa is here with us, screening calls and keeping things light and fun. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone.
Hey, that wasn't the right one. Let's try that again. Well, that's a little better.
Seated at all times, and no smoking, please. Your radio is preset for channel and volume and requires no further adjustment.
This is Talk Time, and we're ready for caller number one. Go ahead, caller number one. Go ahead, caller number one. You're on the air. This is Talk Time. Talk to me.
Yeah, hello.
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 Hello, caller number one. You have something to buy, sell, or trade?
This is the Talk Time.
Yes, this is Talk Time. Go ahead.
Yes, due to technical difficulties, Talk Time has been canceled today.
Well, hello. Hello. Welcome to the Friday Night Free-for-All. And this was your guest host tonight, Alvin McFarlane. And we're going to be taking some calls and discussing some maintenance items. I have one thing I'd like to throw out. Maybe we can discuss a little bit. And after that, it's an open floor. You can bring anything you want, and we'll see what we can do to help you out. Now, I want to remind everybody, if you're listening online and you want to call in, dial in at 347-884-8327 and press 1 on your phone, and that'll put you in the queue. I don't have a call screener tonight, so I'll just be picking up calls live and putting you on the show. What I want to start out with is a winter topic here that I don't think anyone's immune from it, unless you are way down south somewhere where there is no winter. And that is the problem that we have with corrosion from chemicals used to de-ice the roads in the wintertime. And it is a huge problem for the trucking industry. Costs us in the neighborhood of $25 billion, that's with a B, every year in maintenance. These chemicals are so corrosive, they just eat away at our components on our trucks, brake components, steering components, paint, you name it, frames, yeah, just about anything that gets corrosive chemicals splashed on it while going down the road is subject to problems. So stuff on the trailers just get air valves and everything underneath the trailer, cross members, and suspension. And this stuff is really nasty, the stuff, the chlorides that are being used in the last several years, the calcium chloride and magnesium chloride. It's good stuff as far as de-icing the roads goes. It works good. You can the roads department can apply it ahead of time, and if it, you know, it's activated by the moisture, but it's really a problem for, it's really a maintenance headache because just everything it gets on, it does damage to you. Now, one thing I do with my own truck and trailer in the wintertime is I wash it as often as I can. That's once, maybe twice a week, depending on the condition of the roads. And underneath especially, get all as much of the chemical as I can rinsed off every nook and cranny and everywhere I can get to with a car wash hose or even a hose and a nozzle. And then, but what I do when I'm finished washing the chemicals off, what I do is go back and spray on the soap like you would use to, you know, like for a first coat, you'd put on some soap and then rinse it off with water. But what I do is I put that soap on last and I let it dry on the paint and on the frame and on everything. And then when the chemical gets splashed up on there, it's on top of a layer of soap. And so the next, when you go to wash it, it comes off pretty easy and it kind of shields it from damaging the paint. So that's my tip. That's what I do. I'd sure be interested in anything anybody else is doing to combat the effects of corrosion. I don't know a good way other than parking the truck in the winter. I don't know a way you can get away from it totally. And one other thing, I'd like to hear from anyone that has been put out of service for a mechanical problem. And I'd just like to kind of know what happened and, you know, how you, what you had to do and so on. So with that, and I don't see any hands up here, you guys got to mash one on your phone so I know who wants to be on first. And then, there we got somebody. So we'll go ahead and I'm going to take 4844 and you are on live. As soon as I can get you on, there we go. Try that.
Calvin?
Yes, you got, you're on live.
Hey, Alvin, this is Hugh. How are you doing tonight?
Hiya, Hugh. I'm doing wonderful.
Good. Listen, talking about winter, Kevin had a guest on, a couple of months back. He was recommending air brake, airline, antifreeze, or a treatment for your truck to a tractor and trailer to keep your brakes from freezing up, keep your airlines from freezing up, and that sort of thing. And I got a case of that stuff. And I cannot find a practical way of getting it into my air system. Is that something that you use?
Yes, I do. I got some of that, too, and I felt obligated to have to let my trailer freeze up at least once this winter since I had a whole bunch of the stuff. But
getting it in my tractor is hard.
Well, I did have trouble with the tractor, so I guess I've had more trouble over the years with the trailer. And one problem was if you drop and hook a lot, if trailers are sitting around being loaded and the glad hands are open and you're in a blizzard, it'll blow that full of snow and then you hook up your hoses to it and blow that snow back into the system and then you got a problem. So I've had that happen and they make these little metal covers for that. So when I unhook the, I used to drop the trailer where it was loaded, and so when I unhooked, I'd cover that, and then I'd threaten the shag driver if he didn't do that, he was going to pay dearly, and I never had any trouble with the trailer since then. But with the tractor, I did have a situation this year where my unloader valve froze up in the compressor. And so not having an alcohol evaporator on the truck, not really having any other means to put alcohol in, I ended up putting some in through the inlet to the compressor. Now, and that did, you know, take care of my problem. But these trucks these days are equipped with air dryers, which, you know, try and take the liquids and the things like that out of the airflow. But the thing with the alcohol, what you're after is the vapor from it, and that's what actually works its way through the system and kind of combines with the moisture and keeps it from freezing. So if you don't have an alcohol evaporator on your truck, you'll have to pour, you know, introduce a little bit of it into the inlet of the compressor while it's pumping, or the alternate method is to take a hose loose from the air dryer to the air tank.
That's the method I tried, and I got some, and I probably didn't get a pint in it because it's and it's that's really not an easy operation, disconnecting that hose and reconnecting. But if you run it through the compressor, it's just going to be taken out by the air dryer, isn't it?
Well, no, not totally. It'll go through. It'll see the air being compressed is warm, and so that'll vaporize that stuff. And the air dryer is likely to take some of that out, but some of it will go through as a vapor. If you can get a little bit in the system, it'll sit there and vaporize slowly, and you know, it'll last you a while.
Right.
But
well,
I know what you mean. It's really hard to get it in.
And I really have never had a problem with the air system on a tractor ever. I've been driving 26 years. I don't remember ever having a tractor freeze up, but I've definitely had some trailer breaks, especially in a drop and hook operation where, you know, I just had to get under there and manually work the brakes and heat them up and bang on them and everything to get them to release. Getting it in the trailer, I guess, is more important than actually getting it in the tractor, huh?
Yeah, normally that seems like
and
the
it's
most,
a lot easier.
Yeah, and it's a lot easier. And that's, you know, if you're running in cold weather, that's a good thing to do regularly. But if you have, you know, there's two issues there where the air system is froze up is one thing, and then the other one is where
the
brakes themselves are froze to the drums. And so the alcohol in the air system isn't going to help that.
Yeah,
and it is a tough one when you're dropping and hooking because, you know, somebody brings a trailer in with the brakes full of snow and, you know, warm enough to melt it but not dry it off, and then they drop it and go down their merry way, and then you come along and try and grab that trailer, and you got the problem. So,
is there a method that you would recommend to before you drop a trailer in a cold situation that would warm up those brakes without damaging the brakes and remove most of the moisture from the brakes so that they won't be frozen up for the next driver? I'm talking about the actual drop pads and all them.
You can... And a good way to do it, the ideal thing is if the, you know, the trailer has a shield, a dust shield on the brake, and then that usually prevents a lot of the stuff from getting in there in the first place, and it keeps both the moisture out and the corrosive chemicals that you know, cause the problems. But you may not be able to convince, you know, your company to put that on all the trailers. You may get them to spec it on their new ones. But what you can do is you can make a few, you know, if you know you're a few miles from the yard where you're going to drop the trailer, make a few brake applications with the trailer brakes. Doesn't have to be a hard application. Just make a light application and generate a little bit of heat and then let off and do that a few times before you get there, and then we'll have a little heat build up in the shoes and the drums. It'll kind of dry the moisture out. And then I think it was a caller on maybe on Kevin's show that mentioned that park the trailer and then wait a little while for the tires to cool down, and then you know move it a few feet. And that's another good thing, because you know if you come in the tires are worn, you sit on some ice or snow, and then it gets froze down. That's another situation you have to deal with. So there's a couple things you can do anyway.
Yeah, well, those are great tips. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I guess you're seems like I always get the trailer that somebody backed into a snowdrift, and then I have all kinds of problems. So, but you know, you can do your best and kind of let the other trucks in your company know to, you know, kind of see if they can help a little when they drop those trailers, and maybe you get lucky.
Okay, I'm looking forward to being sure tonight.
Okay. Well, I got a few more callers in line here, so I'll sign off here, Hugh, and take the next one.
Thanks.
Okay, we're going to go to 2753 next, and you're on live.
Is that me?
Yeah, that's you. Go ahead.
How you doing tonight, sir?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. How you doing?
I can't complain. I'm still here, so I don't know. That's got to count for something, you know.
Well, hey, I'm here to complain, but nobody's listening, so it doesn't do any good.
It don't do any good. There you go. There you go. Hey, as far as with your topic on the corrosion, as far as electrical, what I usually do is in the beginning of the winter, I use spray silicone. I usually wash the truck down, and as far as all my electrical, where any wires connect or any butt connectors or on the back of the starter and that stuff, I usually spray that stuff down with silicone. And since I started doing that, I've noticed that my wire corrosion problem has gone down drastically. You know, I'm still fighting with the frame and the rest of the stuff, but the silicone seems to work pretty good for the wires.
Well, that's a good idea, and that I didn't even think of. The wiring is one of the major problem area for corrosion, you know, and so that's a good one. There is, like on the connectors, around the back of the truck, you know, in the back of the frame and so on, you can get you can use a corrosion prevention compound or even a dielectric grease, you know, you pack in the connectors, and that keeps the chemicals out. So, but your silicone spray, that's easy. That's a good one for, like you said, around the starter, where those cables that really causes a lot of starting problems, just the corrosion there. So that's a really good idea.
Yeah, because I used to fight that. I do a lot of stuff. I'm in the Southeast, but a lot of my stuff go up to Chicago and Michigan and stuff like that. And I've been fighting the wires. You have a spot where you stick a tester into a wire, you know, a little hole, and once that stuff gets into that little hole, man, it's going to tear that wire up. I've even seen electrical tape, you know, all nicely taped up, but somehow that stuff gets underneath there, and it just goes to hell, man.
Oh, yeah, that stuff can wick its way in, and the salt, the actual salt that they used to use before they started using the calcium chlorides, the salt will go in the copper wire and actually work its way through the wire itself. So you could take a you know, wire and put it in salt water and make it like a U to it, and coming up the other end just from the electrical action, you know, that salt would go on through. And those kind of things are really bad, because that corrosion inside that wire, you know, under the insulation, you can't see it. So when you finally uh-huh. have a problem, you don't know where to work on it. And that's a very difficult trace. And so you want to be very careful about don't poke holes in the wire unless you absolutely have to. And then be very careful about, you know, any abrasion and any wear spots on the wiring harness, because you will have problems with that in the wintertime.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Hey, I got a question. Maybe you have an idea or someone listening. I recently purchased a generator for my truck. Now I'm looking as far as portable heaters. You have any idea what's a good portable heater I could use on the inside, or what kind of BTUs should I be looking for, or anything like that?
You're talking about is it a 110 volt generator?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So you're looking for a portable heater like you'd use in your house, or something like that?
Yeah, something that's going to keep me warm when I'm up there in Chicago.
Yeah. Well, a very good small electric heater is the ceramic type, and you can get a very small with a variable fan speed that's very safe. The type that have the elements that get red hot, you know, those are the least desirable, because they're, you know, they could catch something on fire. But the ceramic ones are very good safety-wise and efficiency-wise. There's also, they're a little bigger, but you get these oil-filled radiator-type heaters, and they're also very efficient and very safe. There's no, you know, there's nothing that'll ignite a fire if you have anything flammable around. They tend to be, the common size of those is they're 1500 watts, and I don't remember off the top of my head what the BTU is, but I actually have a little one I do use in the truck, and I run off the inverter. I only use it to help warm the cab up, the sleeper up a little bit quickly, you know, if I just started the truck. But how big a generator do you have?
I got a 7,500 watt diesel power generator.
Okay, well, yeah, that'll handle about anything you can throw at it there. Depending on how much you need the source of heat, I'm kind of leaning towards adding a fuel-fired heater on mine, and then still run that off of batteries. But I want something that'll also warm the coolant, so I can shut the main engine down when it's really cold. So that's something to think about.
Now, I heard you talk about that on one of your previous podcasts, is where where does that, I don't have one of those plug-ins on my truck, I'm going to eventually get that put in. Where does that actually go? Does that go around the thermostat area, or the water pump, or how does that whole setup work?
Well, are you talking about a block heater, or the, what I'm talking about is like a Webasto heater it's like a little fuel-fired heater that there's two types. One of them just heats the air, and you just use it to heat your sleeper when you're not running. And then the other one, the other type will heat the coolant, and so then you can circulate that through your heating system in the truck, you know, through the engine. And like if you have a fuel heater, you know, it would circulate through that and keep the fuel warm. So based on what you really need, I think, is how you should decide if you want to do something like that. But just to get you going, since you already have the generator and you're generating power, you get a small electric heater like we were talking about. That's, you know, good thing to get you going. But what I would say is you're still going to be limited some on how cold you can let the engine go without idling. If you don't have some way to keep the engine warm.
Okay.
You have enough wattage there. You can run like a 1500 watt block heater too. And so that's another good option. If you have that much power available.
And the block heater is actually what keeps the antifreeze warm while the truck is off?
Yeah, that's what that is a heating element that's inside the coolant, the cooling jacket on the engine, you know. And you plug in and it warms up. You know, you may already have that on your truck.
I actually don't have one of those on my truck.
Well, you don't. Okay. That's fairly inexpensive item to put on there. And then if you have a way to keep your living area, you know, your bunk warm, and a way to keep your engine warm, well, then you're pretty well set for no matter what happens.
Right.
Other than, like, with my own... I don't really like to idle, but below a certain temperature, I do just keep the fuel circulated and keep the fuel warm. When I tend to be under the conditions where I need to do that is where I'm loading a load that's, you know, kind of critical to deliver, and I don't want to, you know, sit there with the thing shut down and then start up and find out I got a fuel problem. And, you know, really under the gun to make a delivery. So those are the conditions where I'll idle it, say if it's below maybe 15 degrees or so. And I'll idle while I'm loading just to make sure I can be up and running. But I don't have the generator capacity, you know, to run the block heater either. So...
All right, that was my 2 cents there, man. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate you checking in. That was good information there on that silicone spray, and we'll have to keep fighting that corrosion problem because they don't think they're going to quit using the chemicals. So
I'm more than likely going to get worse.
Yes, I think they are, and we're just going to have to keep paying on, and hopefully, you know, our manufacturers will keep making you know, better undercoatings and better components and better wiring connectors and all that, kind of help make everything better in the future. But okie doke, we'll move on to the next call here, and it looks like 1755, and it's your turn. And if I can get this right, I think you're on live now.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Well, I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I got a little bit of input on that silicone spray. You got to be careful with that stuff because silicone is a semiconductor, and if it reaches a certain temperature, it will stop conducting. I use Vaseline on my truck. It works as a cleaner and does the same exact thing the dielectric grease does. And your caller about the airline, talking about getting airline antifreeze, I've got a very, very simple, cheap way to get airline antifreeze into your truck. It requires 2 3/8 petcock valves and a 1/2 inch to 3/8 T fitting. And you just take it, put it on the rear end of the pump where the feed line comes off on the 1/2 inch side, and you run the 1/2 inch straight through and just cut off a little section there and put a piece of flex line in there, and then put 2 petcock valves separated off of that with, I'd say, probably about 4 or 5 inches will do it, and you turn both petcock valves off, and then whenever you have a freezing problem, you open one petcock valve, dump your airline antifreeze into it, close the top petcock valve, open the bottom, and your airline antifreeze goes right into the system.
Now, are you putting that at the outlet of the air dryer?
Yes, at the outlet of the air dryer.
Okay, got it. Yeah.
Your air dryer creates enough heat to not ever have a problem up there. Or no, not the air dryer. At the air pump up on the front of the
compressor. So you're putting that on the discharge line of the air compressor?
Yes.
Or on the suction side. Okay.
No, not on the suction side. Don't put the airline. Like I said, the air compressor generates enough heat itself to never cause a problem up there.
Well, as long as it doesn't cool down. What happened to mine is when it's sitting, I never have any problems until I shut it off at home. And that's where I had the problem. It cooled down and must have a little moisture in the unloader valve, and so it wouldn't build up any pressure.
See, when you have an issue like that, all you would have to do is open that top petcock valve, dump the airline antifreeze in while you're idling, getting ready to shut down. Close your top petcock valve, open your bottom petcock valve, and then pump your air brakes about 10 or 15 times, and that'll remove any ambient moisture inside of your system.
Yeah, that would be a good way to get it in the system. There is a alcohol injector system that's made for the pressure side of the system, and that's the type of thing that trucks that run in the, you know, like in Canada and the north, the extreme cold, they always are equipped with something like that. But
if we look at cost-effectiveness, you're looking at about a $25 investment for what I'm saying, and those systems that you're talking about, what do they run, a couple hundred bucks?
Yeah, they're a couple hundred bucks, and you know, it isn't it's something you could put on if you're running northern states all the time and in Canada, but in you know, if you don't run the cold that much, and a deal like you're talking about is fairly inexpensive to buy those fittings. You don't put that on, so that's a good tip.
Yep, that's all I got for you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was a good one, and I appreciate it.
Not a problem. You have a good night.
Okay, you too. And, okay, what I'm going to do is remind everybody, if you're listening online, to go ahead and dial in 347-884-8327. And if you want to get on and make a comment or pass along a tip, or you got some other problem, well, you just push 1 on your phone, and we will get you in on the show live here, and we can discuss anything you want. And you know, something else I wanted to mention that I do in the wintertime to combat the effects of the chemicals is when, after I wash the truck, I grease it. I like to grease it and force the chemicals out of the, you know, like around the kingpin bushings and springpin bushings. So I probably grease the truck way more often in the winter than I do in the summertime, just for that reason, just to keep fresh grease in there, keep the components all lubed up. And, you know, from the times we're washing it constantly to try and remove all the chemicals, so we end up getting more water in there or just the chemicals wicking in there. So that's another thing I do. Trying to think, most of the things that I've had fail or, you know, get damaged where I have to replace is like air valves, linkages on leveling valves, brake chambers, brake components. Brake shoes are something that really takes a beat. And there's a condition that actually breaks the brake, fracture the brake lining. What happens is the chemicals get on the brake shoes and kind of wick its way underneath between the lining and the brake shoe. And then as the corrosion takes place, you know, the rust and the corrosion expand, and they'll actually crack the brake shoe. That's something you really want to watch for, because at the DOT inspections, they're looking for stuff like that. There's a criteria for where the cracks might be and how, you know, severe they are and so on. They go through a rivet hole, and there's a criteria for it. But just about any crack is going to put you in danger of, you know, getting some kind of violation, if not an out of service. So you want to be inspecting your brake shoes really often. And so one thing I've kind of decided to do, I just started doing with my trailers, is I start rotating the tires in the spring and in the fall. And what I'm doing in the spring is I pull all the tires and wheels off and pull all the drums off and then steam clean the brake shoes and get all the chemical off from that's accumulated over the winter. And I've noticed that, you know, I've gotten corrosion even on the rivet heads of some of the brake shoes. And luckily, you know, if you can get it off of there, you don't have any, and the rust jacking is called to break the linings. But if you leave the stuff, and it's something that you don't really notice unless you're under there looking, or if you don't have a good, you know, if you have brake shields, dust shields on, you can't see the linings very well. So sometimes kind of tough to know what's going on. But a good inspector will be finding a way to look in there, and you don't want to get a surprise at an inspection. So you make sure you, if you don't inspect your brakes yourself, make sure that whoever you have do it, you know, tell them you want a good inspection on those brake shoes for any damage. Anybody else that has a comment to make, you just mash one. I don't have anybody in the queue right now. I'm trying to think what other items I've done for corrosion other than constantly washing the truck all winter. And the exhaust is very frequent, you know, to have to replace exhaust clamps and exhaust pipes and so on from the effects of that. This corrosive stuff gets underneath the clamps and then just rusts out the pipes, and a lot of times you can't see it until it rusts in two and falls apart. So that's another item to be very diligent at inspecting, because that's another thing that the DOT inspectors have really went after, you know, as far as out of service items. Okay, it looks like we got another hand up here. We're going to go to 2324 this time, and you're live on the show. And that I hope it wasn't something like that. Caller looked like he dropped off right when I brought him on, so we'll see if he can get back in and get back on here in a little bit. Anybody else that wants to make a comment or has a problem, why be sure to hit one on your phone, and I'll get you in the queue here. Some of the really crazy things that get damaged from these chemicals are that you wouldn't think it would damage a tire. If you run over a nail, have a nail hole or any kind of a, you know, damage to a tire, that chemical gets in and wicks its way through the steel in the tire. Now, I've never personally ever had a tire that failed from that, but I had some casings that were really good shape that I sent in to be recapped, and they came back and found, you know, like a nail hole, and they went and cleaned out the nail hole and found rust in there, and usually anything, sometimes they'll let it go if it's just in one localized little spot, but anything into the second belt, they won't recap the tire. So there's another thing that you know, not everybody uses recaps, but a lot of casings get, you know, recapped if they are suitable. But just a one little bitty nail hole might not even went through the tire, but it went in far enough to let that chemical wick into the steel of the tire will do damage. Exhaust, brakes, the tires, all the wheels is another area where you get. I had bought some new wheels a few years back, some brand new aluminum wheels, and you got some of that. You know, after running in the winter time, they had enough residue on there that it etched the surface of the polished wheels. The stuff will get in between the wheels and corrode. Like, you can get the wheels actually seized onto the hubs. The holes, you know, the stud holes will get corrosion in there. Sometimes you can't get them off. You get corrosion around the mating surfaces on the brake drum and the hubs. You got to be really careful on that when doing a brake job. If you have any rusting and corrosion in there, you need to remove that so when you put the brake drum on, it has a flat surface to mate up to. Otherwise, you'll get a out of balance, you know, you'll have a problem there. And rusting in the threads on the fasteners all over the truck, that's, you know, if you have any bolts on the frame or wheel nuts, all that type of stuff. Now, it looks like we got another caller in the queue here. I'm going to go to 3106 this time, and you're on the show. Hello there, 3106. Hello. Hello, we have a caller there.
The ropes back here. Yeah, different kinds, yes, sir. Got fish in the neck there.
Well, I think that occasionally this happened to me where I had the phone in my pocket, and one time I crawl up the ladder to work on my reefer, and Lisa comes on and starts talking to me, so I didn't really mean to mash that one that time, and it just accidentally happened. So maybe something like that. But anybody that does want to get in and chime in or has another problem you want to discuss, why, hit one on your phone and we'll get you in the queue here. I guess, you know, we got to look at, you know, we discuss a lot on the downside of or the problems that we see from the chemical. What point we have to look at, you know, if it saves one life or 10 lives or 100 lives, you know, it's something we'll have to deal with, you know, and I think the safety's got to be the number one concern, and I do believe there's, you know, safety-wise, it does make a lot of sense when you use it on bridges and roads and so on. There's a lot of drivers that aren't real, they don't do too good in the winter weather, so they're not real experienced with that. So it does help save lives if it rusts out all our vehicles. We're going to go to 8102 this time, and you're live on the show.
Hi, Eldon. This is Tim.
Hello, Tim.
I've got a 97 Freightliner Sentry that's got a fan hub that's going out, and I was wondering if you could recommend, like, going to an electric fan, a company brand name, or where to go to look for that?
What type of fan do you have on there now?
Well, it's just the Freightliner belt-driven, you know.
Is it a clutch fan?
And
it would be some sort of, you know what brand it is?
No, I don't. It's whatever came on the truck. It's a Detroit Series 60 engine.
Well, there are several brands. Horton is pretty popular back in those days. Finding an electric one that has the capacity to move enough air is the problem. And guys that attempt that, they usually put, you know, several fans on there to be able to keep the engine cool in the hot weather. And the other thing you have to have air movement for is the air conditioning, and also for the charge air cooler.
Right.
So it's a difficult thing for one. You know, I don't know of any one simple replacement for that, that'll, you know, cover everything.
Okay.
There are some heavy duty, real heavy duty fans that would be the ones to use if you're going to do something like that. But I don't know the brand name right off the top of my head.
Okay. Well, I just didn't think I would want to just go with replacing what was there. You know, Kevin talks about saving the fuel economy and so on by going to electric components, and thought maybe this was an opportunity for me.
Well, I just would say that I'd be cautious about something that isn't really tried and, you know,
right. And that's
well. I know there's some.
I thought maybe you guys had experience with testing some of that.
Well, I have a little on light duty vehicles, and we did run into a problem where we couldn't find a fan that could draw enough air to take care of the, you know, to keep the thing cool and keep the air conditioner going. Yeah, it was great because it didn't, you know, we didn't have any noise and didn't run when it didn't need to, but
right.
After, you know, after we got the sun, you know, after it was a good hot afternoon, we didn't have too good of luck. So you have to size that for the worst conditions you're going to come across. And
right. A mechanic told me it's going to cost about $1,100 to replace that, you know, with the same thing that's on there. So I just thought, well, maybe there's something different available.
Well, there are some different things available. for the regular belt-driven fans. Horton has one that they call a, I can't tell you the name right off the top of my head. Maybe I'll think of it here. But what it does, it's like a two-stage thing. And it has the air system will lock the fan up if you need the full flow. But many times in the traffic, you know, you don't really need the fan fully on, but you need a little bit of airflow moving through. And the way they do that is with what they call an electrical eddy current. It's sort of a little magnetism that, you know, kind of spins the fan, but yet it doesn't really draw, you know, like if the fan hub's turning at 100 RPM, this thing might turn at 20 RPM. So it doesn't really draw a lot of horsepower to do that. And so if you were going to go to a replacement, those types, there's another popular one that is, again, I can't spit it out here, but Kaiser, that's it. Kaiser makes one of those also, so if you have a Kaiser fan, they also have that. And there's an outfit that makes just replacement parts, and they make a kit where you can convert your fan, so you have several options if you want to go to that. And are you a member on the website?
Yes, I am.
If you go to my page on the website and leave me a message, I will get the names and the websites of all those for you, and you can read up on them and see if anything there would be, you know, what you're
all
looking
right
for. And now I want to go to did you have any other questions?
No, thank you, Alden. It was most helpful.
Okay. And thanks for checking in. The reason I want to get to, there's another hand up, and maybe somebody has some more information pass along. So I want to get to that before we run out of time. So I'll move on to the next one here. It's 8731, and you are on live.
Alden, Jimmy the Junk Man checking in.
Well, hello, Jimmy the Junkman.
Well, I switched over to the Evans coolant a while back, and as part of the conversion, we went with the system of four electrical fans. I'm real happy with the conversion. I've got two dashboard switches. If I need the fans to come on, I've got two switches. Each one does two fans. And then I've got they're also thermostatically driven, so they come on when they're supposed to. And I switched to 215 thermostats, and I've been real happy with the conversion. Now, you did bring up the problem with the hot weather and getting enough air across your condenser when you're trying to keep your cab cool with your air conditioner. That's the problem I'm having right now, and what I've got to do is either close up the space around the fans and make sure that they're pulling more, or I've got to go up another level of magnitude on the fan. Other than that, I've been real happy with the system.
Now, what brand of fans did you use?
Well, I was listening to the call, and I was trying to think of it. We just got some fans out of one of these aftermarket automotive catalogs.
Okay. Now there is an outfit. I just can't think of the name, but I'll do some hunting. There's an outfit that makes a heavy duty fan, which is heavier than an automotive type and probably able to draw more air through, that it's big enough that it can be used on some mid-sized trucks, you know, and maybe some light duty stuff. You know, the problem is our light duty trucks have more horsepower than, you know, our trucks used to have. So you got to have enough capacity to cool that, you know. But
absolutely, yeah. I think I've got like 15 or 16 inch diameter fans. There's four of them, and I could go with like 2 or 3 inches larger diameter. And maybe I'll, you know, this is kind of a testing in progress. So if we do switch them out, we'll go for something a little bit stronger, and you know, see what happens.
How long have you had that on there?
It's been since ever since the fire, September.
Okay, so you didn't really have it in the real hot weather. You had
we were uncomfortable there for a little bit on some of the late summer stuff, and I was glad to see it kind of get cool. So I'm definitely gonna figure something out before I get into next summer, you know.
Now, do you have it hooked in so that, say, you get a signal from the engine that the air through the charge air cooler is too hot, will that turn the fan on too?
We don't have it wired to for a sensor in the charge air cooler, but I'm probably running the fan, you know, more than I need to, because it's not costing me any horsepower to run them, you know. I'm watching my my water temperature and my engine oil temperature, and they're staying real constant with this system. So so I'm real happy with that. One of the problems I had before this coolant swap out was that, you know, the Detroit was running too cool, you know, and I think I've seen a nice improvement, you know, since I've switched over to the Evans.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, the thing, you know, I think an electric fan system is promising if we can come up with something big enough to move enough air when we really need it. And then the rest of the time, you know, you keep the switch shut off. Or you have a small one, you know, a smaller fan to flow enough for your AC, and then a bigger one, you know, if you really get in the desert. But
Maybe do a different system with the charge air cooler. Get the charge air cooler out and the condenser out in a more airflow situation. Maybe even separate them from the radiator, you know, by a couple of inches. I think they're probably picking up a lot of heat from the radiator.
Well, that's something we'll have to keep in touch on and see how you're doing on that, and maybe we can come up with some ideas for something else for you to test there.
Yeah, it's a work in progress.
Well, it sounds good. Well, I'm glad you checked in and give us an update on that. We are just about out of time, so I'm going to work at our way towards getting signed off here. I do appreciate everybody calling in and bringing some thoughts to the show tonight, and we'll look forward to doing it again in the future. I'm going to mash a button here and let Willie Nelson take us on out tonight, and we will catch you all next time.
And still is still moving to me. 1, 2, 3, 4...
swim like a fish in the sea all the time. But if that's what it takes to be free, I don't mind. Still, still moving to me. Still, still moving to me. And it's hard to explain how I feel. It won't go in words, but I know that it's real. I can be moving or I can be still, but still, still moving to me. Still, still moving to me. And it's hard to explain how I feel. Won't go in words, but I know that it's real. I can be moving or I can be still, but still, still moving to me. Still, still moving to me.
Moving. That's what I say when I got my truck in the snow. We'll catch you all next time.